recognize or understands who understands the self. And people that arrived here in Turtle Island in the Americas came to, I think there's definitely something here on the island that was still connected to the land, and that the people that lived in the Americas was people of integrity and were living harmoniously with land. And I think it's just important to remember that how they became the people that they were is because their first teachers were the ones I was describing as the plant life and all of creation. And it was that relationship to the land, to the plant life, to the water people. They were our first teachers, and they taught us how to be living here, to be respecting. They taught us about our principles and values and co-designed ceremonies, how to celebrate together, how to honor each other. And I believe this is not just limited to indigenous people, it's to all peoples.
I think that that piece that you said about coincidence is really key there, because it was no coincidence that people who had forgotten that connection were drawn to this land to be connected to the people who had remembered that connection. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a purpose for them being drawn here, and there's a purpose for us maintaining those connections and those teachings that we can share with one another going forward.
Yes, I agree.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Mi'kmaqan. We really appreciate every word that you've offered.
Thank you. I hope you guys edit me well.
And I appreciate every breath that you offer the world, my friend.
Thank you.
Leilin.
Lalio. Talk to you later, Sherry.
Okay.
Bye.
I'd like to thank both Mi'kmaqan and Chris George, Chiwiliwan, Walaylin. Thank you for being with us this week.
And thank you, Sherry, for also being with us this week. Our listeners should know that Occupy Radio is produced through KWVA 88.1 FM on the campus of the University of Oregon. We are syndicated on the Pacifica Radio Network, and we'd like to thank our invisible co-host this week, David Getchi Sierra Lupe, who, as always, is doing the technical and editing end and so much more for Occupy Radio.
If you'd like to connect with Occupy Radio, please drop us a line at Occupy Radio 23 on Twitter and Gmail. We're Occupy Radio on Stitcher and iTunes. You can find us on Facebook on the Occupy Radio group page, and we are on occupyradio.org.
For Occupy Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. Treaties and relationships have been the themes on this week's show, which begs the question, listeners. What is the state of your own agreements with family, community, and the natural world? Maybe you'll be doing some soul-searching questioning and life-changing reflecting by the time we talk to you next week.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm. The time is 6:04. Stay tuned for a special audio of Feminist Current, featuring Megan Murphy, who speaks with Sarah Slayman, a political consultant and women's rights activist based out of Houston, Texas. Sarah worked with worked for Bernie Sanders and cast a vote for Hillary on election night. Also after that, stay tuned for an episode of Women's International News Gathering Service, which examines the effectiveness of Black women's contributions to the U.S. labor movement and profiles 27 rising Black women leaders. Robin Williams, one of the profiled leaders, discusses the revitalization of the labor movement under the influence of the Fight for 15 and Black Lives Matter. She recounts trials and triumphs from her and others' organizing work. So stay tuned for that. And of course, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from All Classical Portland, presenting Mark O'Connor's An Appalachian Christmas, featuring the O'Connor Band and guest Nancy Ives, Wednesday, December 14th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. An Appalachian Christmas features seasonal carols infused with bluegrass, folk, and Americana on banjos, fiddles, mandolin, and upright bass. A holiday tradition for Portlanders. Tickets at allclassical.org.
KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring for the following three positions: Station Manager, Evening News and Public Affairs Director, and Director of Underwriting. To apply to one of these positions, send a cover letter and resume to hiring@kbu.org, or bring or mail your resume with cover letter to 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer the following question: why is KBOO important? Open until filled. Interviews will begin around December 9th. No phone calls, please. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. For more information, go to kboo.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Hay Fever, produced by the Portland Actors Conservatory and running from December 2nd to December 18th. In Hay Fever, the Bliss family have all invited house guests for the weekend. Artistic eccentricity and flirtation are misinterpreted and hilarity ensues. Again, that's Hay Fever, produced by the Portland Actors Conservatory and running December 2nd to December 18th. The play takes place at 1436 Southwest Montgomery Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
There you got my story. Just ask a woman. There you got my story. Trouble.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. On November 8th, American voters elected not the first female president of the United States, an exceedingly qualified, tough, smart woman named Hillary Rodham Clinton, but a sociopathic reality TV star who hates women, people of color, immigrants, and actually, I think it's fair to say Donald Trump simply hates people, all of them. The blow was crushing and still feels unreal. But here we are, so what's next? We need to learn from this, move forward, and take action. I spoke with Sarah Slayman, a political consultant and women's rights activist, about her perspective on the political climate in the U.S., what went wrong in this election, and what needs to happen next, on the ground, and in progressive movements more broadly. Sarah worked for Bernie Sanders and cast a vote on Tuesday for Hillary Clinton. I spoke with her over the phone from her home in Houston, Texas. Here's that interview. So I know I've been feeling incredibly angry and distressed about the results of the election from over here in Canada, and I can only imagine the feeling over there across the border. I wonder if you can tell me your initial reaction. How are you holding up over there?
Both days since election night have been incredibly tough. I personally have been overwhelmed, wake up with a start at about 4:38 each morning, and I immediately remember what's happened. I get very fearful, a lot of crying throughout the day, and throughout my network of activists and folks and people that I know across the state of Texas and across the country, that seems to be pretty much the case for everyone on our side of things, is a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, a lot of anger, and a lot of tears.
I wonder, this is a really big question, but... A really big question. Why did this happen? How have we come to a time and place where Donald Trump, of all people, we all thought it was a joke when this all first began, and it's not a joke anymore. How did this happen? How is it that a person like this has been elected president of the United States?
A lot of my friends who work in Democratic politics and work for elected officials might be unhappy with me for saying this, but the Republic is in total crisis, and both parties are in crisis. And it was more well known at the beginning of the season that it was a both party thing. And then when Secretary Clinton gained the nomination for our side, the media narrative and our side's narrative became more about how they were having a crisis. In truth, the crisis never stopped on both sides. The two-party system has been under a lot of pressure from elites and really wealthy folks for a long time. And it's pushing and it's crumbling on both sides, and there's division happening on both sides. And there's rebuilding on both sides. And in the meantime, in that vacuum, a bunch of dispossessed people started wanting change on both sides of the party. And at one extreme end of the spectrum, that was a large white population in the middle of the country. Our country is still about 74% Caucasian, and a lot of those people live in the middle, and they aren't polled. Polling methods have become pretty outdated. It used to be where you could get a 40% return on a telephone poll or a cell phone poll, and now you can get about 9 to 10% off those polls. So underpolling people, not understanding the level of distaste for the establishment. And as we saw in the emails leaked from the DNC, our side believed that the Democrats' narrative about the right wing was so well accepted that having Donald Trump would actually be a better nominee to go against. When he quickly made, mincemeat of the 15 people behind him, we should have taken that more seriously, and we didn't. And that's how we got to today. We underestimated and underpolled angry white voters.
And I think it's pretty easy to react by saying, America is full of irrational bigots, but and there are irrational bigots in the U.S. and in Canada and in other places throughout the world, of course. But there's more to it than that. There has to be more to it than that. It's more complex than that. Mm-hmm. What do you think is behind this? There's a lot of white women that voted for Trump. Although it was mostly white men, it wasn't only white men. I think that a lot of people are just incredulous, right? They don't understand how people could witness all that Trump has done and said and still choose him as president. What's going on there?
So when we look at the electorate who voted, we know that 48%, nearly half of people who could vote, didn't vote. So who knows if those people are just as bigoted and don't care, so they didn't care, or if they're so depressed and so undereducated civically and so stressed that they do oppose him or not. But from what we know about the 50% or so who did vote, more than half of those people voted for Hillary Clinton. She won the popular vote. And an outdated system of weighting votes called the electoral system, founded by the Hamilton that neoliberals gushed over all year, it really caught up with us in this election. Doesn't look like we'll be able to get rid of it for a while, but I want your listeners to understand that the majority of votes went to Hillary Clinton. Unfortunately, they weren't dense and clustered in the places that would have given it more electoral college weight. So that's your square one. Most voters rejected an agenda like Donald Trump's. Underneath that understanding, you know, we're so far behind when it comes to female, you know, executives. Were we going to erase hundreds of years of patriarchy in our democracy, not just in the system that you know, nominated her, but in the electorate that would elect her in one election? You know, this 53% of white women, when we all say they all must be racist, they all must be that, there's that. And then there's a lot of people, you know, who anecdotally reported, my husband will kill me if he thinks I vote that way. Mm-hmm. Or who said things like, I don't know if a woman can be president. If a woman's misogyny is so internalized, if everyone in her family has always raised her belief that she wouldn't amount to anything more than a caretaker, if they don't even politicize her, they don't even look at her when they talk about news at the table, did we expect on election day that she would be self-actualized enough to cross over? I don't know. The feminist part of me goes that way. You know, the organizer for justice in me doesn't have any sympathy for those white women. You know, 53% of them, and it should be mentioned, older, you know, women, betraying immigrants, betraying, you know, women's health, betraying freedom of religion. It's unacceptable. The 37% of Latino men, the 26% of Latino women who did this. It's unacceptable. But American politics are so right-wing. You know, what we consider our centrist woman voter who might go with us, by any other measure in so many countries, is right-wing. I think it was unrealistic to expect her success as a nominee to translate for women voters what Barack Obama would translate for the African-American vote. I think it's flawed analysis. And I think that is, that's kind of a partial explanation.
Mm. And I want to talk about direct impacts on people. You know, this is something that a lot of us are, you know, arguing about online, but there's going to be real serious impacts for real people because of this. I wonder if you can talk a bit about, you know, how will a Trump presidency actually impact real people, marginalized people, women, the working class, people of color, immigrants, refugees?
I have to. I feel like, you know, I have to take everything he said very seriously and assume he is going to do a lot of what he promised. And that's a very serious threat to all the communities you just mentioned. You know, some people are trying to posit that was to win that white vote he needed because he was only ever going to be able to beat her with a 70% turnout of the white vote. And some people say that's to please the donor. You know, certain classes of the base voter, you know, the donor class will want different things. But if you take a look at his proposed transition team, it's terrifying. They're some of the worst elected officials and advisors from the right wing in our country. So I think there are very serious threats to our Social Security system, our Medicare system, all social benefits. There's very serious threats to health care. It's all very real. Congress has been so dysfunctional that it's hard to tell how will they get this agenda done. But on the other hand, they've been dysfunctional because they've been obstructionists. And if they're ready to just open the floodgates and kill the Senate filibuster and give him whatever he wants, this stuff could happen very quickly. So I think everyone on the left right now is kind of scrambling to prepare for the worst of it. And in some ways, I'm worried about that. I don't want us to play like a purely like reactionary game like we need to hold true to getting certain things done the whole time, no matter what. But on the other hand, it's hard not to feel like you don't have to triage right now because people are really under threat.
I wonder if you can speak to, you know, what happens next for the American women's movement? What do they do? You know, what happens, what do they have to do in terms of the reproductive rights movement? I mean, this is a president who brags about sexual assault, who calls women dogs and fat pigs, who brazenly objectifies women, who, you know, clearly doesn't even see women as human, never mind as equal. What does the women's movement in the U.S. do in the face of all this?
I think the most marginalized women, you know, we have to get together as quickly as possible to protect them from the deepest harm. But this election was also the clearest indication that we made little to no real gains in the feminist movement. And we haven't had the idea that a third wave existed is beginning to be more and more like fantastical to me. You know, like what progress have we made since '70 to see the obscene hatred and rejection of this female candidate who, you know, as you know, full disclosure, I staffed for Bernie Sanders from January to May of 2016. But as flawed as she was to reject her so hatefully and so unitedly against this man really speaks to the patriarchy and white nationalism in our country, right? Mm-hmm. And patriarchy is a fundamental undergirding part of white nationalism and most nationalism and fascism. And I think that it will actually result in organizing, some of the first real organizing we've had since the 70s. And because people in the margins are the most affected, I think some of that organizing will be more intersectional and better than it was in the 70s. But I hope we all take a really hard look at what we have called feminist organizing up until now. And the fact that women, you know, continue to be in the majority of the Democratic electorate in many places, and we still couldn't get this done. And kind of look at what are common calls for women across multiple classes and how do we help them. You know, the things that unite women may not be the things that neoliberal feminists check off in a box. So I think it'll be a moment of action organization because women are naturally caretakers, because women do most organizing and a lot of the tough grunt work falls on them. But there's philosophical questions about the feminist movement that will have to be answered in the coming months and years.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the left more broadly, I mean, the left is kind of famous for infighting and for eating its own. And that's happening now, you know, after this election, after the results came out. I think I saw people on the left immediately attacking each other and blaming one another. What's a better, more productive approach?
I think a better, more productive approach right now is to take stock of who's doing what work where and what resources we have and how we can move together. And if we know our guiding principles, maybe we couldn't agree on exact policy or platform proposals a few months ago, but we know that we're all united on not allowing xenophobic policies to go through, not allowing our healthcare to be stripped away, not allowing employee pensions to be stripped away, not allowing unionization to be stripped away. If we can agree on these things, we need to try to pull our resources, because I'm coming from a pessimistic side right now thinking that we're going to have to move quickly, as fast as they're moving, and we'll have less time for that. So I would say that I think the left was all but dead, and then this year we saw little spurts of it from the Bernie Sanders campaign. And if people are ready to do work, they'll get involved. I don't look to places like Brooklyn, New York, and Washington, D.C. for a lot of that left leadership. It's the truth. People that I love and respect work in both of those places. But the people who obviously desperately need organizing are in these ex-urban communities. So I would say that it's a focus of the left to keep rallying the people in the cities who always support us, but to get inside and rip out the cancer in our ex-urban and suburban communities. And because if we don't fight for these young white voters too, we have to reserve and honor and take care of our communities on the margins. But there are simply more white young people. And fascists will recruit these people. So we need to get together very quickly. That's my hope.
Mm-hmm. There's protests going on. You know, last night there were protests in the U.S. against Trump. And I think that's great. I think it's great that people get out on the street. Do you think you know, sometimes I worry that nothing comes of that kind of stuff. Do you think something will come of those kinds of those protests that were happening last night?
You know, when I was a lot of those people's age, I grew up, I came of age during Bush, and anti-war protests were a huge part of my politicization. And I do believe that it's important for these people to get together right now and share and bond and come together right in this moment, right after the election, with their peers, and bond through this and meet and connect and network through this to show him immediately that, you know, a little bit more than half of the electorate didn't even vote for you, and we don't want you, and you're not legitimate to us. I think that's important. Of course, as an organizer, I think long term, you need a purposeful action. We need to pressure them with actions. But right now, it's only natural, and I have no judgment about it. You know, I marched against the Iraq War. The world marched against the Iraq War, knowing pretty much that it was going to happen by February of 2003, right? And it didn't stop. And I met great people and learned incredible organizing lessons. So I won't deny the youth that right now. If you're 50 years old and all you've ever done to go to protest on the left, please get out of the way. But these kids right now, I can't imagine what it's like. I was 15 years old when George W. Bush got elected. It's what guided my life. I knew my president was an intelligent or good enough person to be in control of the country. Left me feeling very powerless, out of control. I began to organize my community. Imagine being a 19-year-old kid watching the adult electorate let you down like this. This is worse. So if they need to get out and scream, I want them to scream right now.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I mean, for those of us who are living outside the U.S., is there anything that we can do, you know, in Canada and the U.K.? What can we do to support these U.S.-based movements, to support, you know, what's going on in the U.S. to push back against the Republicans and against Trump? Is there anything that we can do to, you know, show solidarity and actually help affect change?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I think the differences between, like, Theresa May and Angela Merkel's reactions to our election news is a good example. And I think that that's because Angela Merkel has, like, a kind of a more assembled, like, political force behind her that will keep her in line. And she was unwilling to, like, in any way, shape, or form be warm about accepting the result. So we need you to, just as much as we're going to protest every day of his presidency, because I don't think he's magically going to become, like, a problem solver or kind to us. I have no problem saying that I'm committing to an obstructionist agenda now. I need you to act in concert with your elected officials to keep pressure on them to reject him, to delegitimize him, to refuse him, to refuse his backers, as much as possible. I want to neuter him. He doesn't have a mandate. Less than half of people actually voted for him. So you can't donate money to our orgs. That's illegal. But you can share your experience, your stronger leftist history with us, and you can pressure your government not to play ball with him at all costs.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. That's great advice. And thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it. This has been really insightful, and I'm really excited to, you know, bring your experience and your perspective to Canadians as well as to the rest of our audience.
And I want to take a moment to say thank you to all the Canadians who contributed to that campaign in the middle of our very long and terrible election this year, where you all reminded us of why we were great. And I just am so sorry and wish that we had lived up to some of our better traditions. And it was one of the few hopeful, positive spots during our cycle. And we love y'all for that, and thank you very much.
You just heard an interview with Sarah Slaman, a 31-year-old political consultant and women's rights activist based out of Houston, Texas. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Google Play, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Show the world radical feminism is worth listening to. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced and edited by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org. And finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button. Just ask a woman. There you got my story. Trouble, trouble. There you got my story. Just ask a woman. Just ask a woman. Any woman, any woman. Today on Wings, the power of Black women's organizing in the U.S. labor movement.
We're winning. We're winning.
Stay tuned. There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Today we celebrate Black women labor leaders. I'm Kate Raphael. The other day, I dropped in on a Twitter town hall on Black workers. I had never been to a Twitter town hall before, and I'm still not sure I know exactly what it is. But one of the things I learned there is that Black women are the most receptive to union organizing of any group of workers in the U.S., and campaigns with Black women leaders are most likely to succeed. These findings came from a report by the Black Worker Initiative of the Institute for Policy Studies called And Still I Rise, and I will speak with one of the women leaders profiled in that report, Robin Williams. Don't go away.
You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise.
And Still I Rise, Black Women Labor Leaders, Voices, Power, and Promise, is a report created by researchers Kimberly Freeman Brown and Mark Bayard for the Black Worker Initiative, which is a project of the Institute for Policy Studies. Over 400 women responded to a survey, but the researchers also interviewed 27 women leaders. Robin Williams is one of them. I imagine that was an interesting name to be growing up with, Robin.
Absolutely.
But she's not Robin Williams, the comedian back from the grave. She is the Associate Director of Civil Rights and Community Action for United Food and Commercial Workers International Union based in Washington, D.C. Robin, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Kate. When I was interviewed for this report, I was the Associate Director of Civil Rights for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. But since then, I became the Director of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Civil Rights Department and International Vice President. So I have.
You have been promoted, so great. Congratulations.
Yes, and to another level of leadership since this report.
Well, what do you think significant about doing a study like this?
I think that the report really tells what we've already know, right? That Black women are leaders. It also tells a story about how Black women love their union. That women that are in unions, we understand the power of unions. We understand the power of unity and numbers. And the report also shows that Black women are more likely to organize into unions. And Black women are good union organizers. Black women want to lead, right? Not because we have a big ego, but we want to make sure that our voices are heard. But Black women also speak for, I think, for working families, right? We are head of households, you know, more often than white women. We raise our children, but we also support our brothers as well. So the report interviewed working Black women, but also Black women that are already in the labor movement. It told stories, right? Real stories of our struggles and our success and also what we want to do, right? What we want to do moving forward.
Great. So can you talk about your own history, how you came into the labor movement?
I had my son when I was 18, and I'm a daughter of a preacher. We grew up, you know, with strict Black religious values. So after I had my son, I was in school, but I also wanted to work because I didn't want my parents to be left with taking care of my son. I was fortunate enough to get a job for the federal government for a while, but I also worked for Safeway grocery store. And working for Safeway, I realized I had a union, and it was the union actually my father was in when he was working. And my union representative would come in the store, and I thought he had a lot of power, right, to create change. And so I was just really intrigued about the power of a union. So I got involved in the union. And I was asked to be a shop steward. So I was a shop steward for Safeway employees. And we was a close, you know, knit group. After about 5 years, my union asked me to come out and help to organize. So I would come out on leave and help organize. In 1997, my union, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, was organizing a nursing home in Southern Maryland. And the union organizers had gotten to a point where they could not gather any more support for the organizing campaign. It was a veterans home in St. Mary's County, Maryland, and a lot of the white nurses had signed up on union cards, and they were active in the campaign. But the majority of the nurses and the nursing assistants were black women. So I was asked by my union to come out and to help, you know, go and talk to these women about joining the union. And I did. We had access to the break room and the grounds where they would come outside and smoke cigarettes or come outside and have lunch. And I started, you know, talking to women, both black and white women, about just issues around having enough health care for themselves and what the company was providing for health care, the wages, time home with your own children, but also nurses and nursing assistants, they really care for their patients. So I was able to relate to these women because we basically talked about women issues. So we won that campaign 2 days before Christmas in 1997. And after that, I was hired as an organizer. Then I became a lead organizer for my local union. And I really loved organizing. And so I went on to organize more healthcare workers and training union organizers. And after a few years, my local union president asked me to be a union representative. So I had about 2,500 people in my unit, grocery store workers, healthcare workers, and I had one meatpacking plant. And so I represented our members, and I enjoyed doing that because I worked in Safeway for 13 years, so I knew a union contract, and I really enjoyed that. And then in 2005, I was asked to come work for my international union. And I've been at the United Food and Commercial Workers Union since 2005. There, we had a big organizing campaign at Smithfield Meatpacking Plant in North Carolina. It was a 16-year campaign, and we won that campaign finally in 2008 with the help of community leaders throughout the country. And these workers just, you know, were really great in coming together and organizing. And I do a lot of work. Some people know me as, you know, always beating up on Walmart. We've done a lot of work across the country around Walmart. But I always do my work because I'm in civil rights. I try to do my work through a racial, social, and economic justice lens. Because it's not just about getting more members to become dues-paying union members. It's really about helping all of us to become more empowered in the workplace, in the political arena, socially and economically. So that's what I really enjoy. That's the kind of short version of how I got involved in this work. And I think it's very similar for me to growing up in the church. You know, we always supported each other. And my father was a Christian minister, but he preached about self-sacrifice and community empowerment as well. He helped to integrate a lot of businesses in North Carolina, Ronald Graphics, North Carolina, which is his home. I have a sister that's gay. In the 60s and 70s, being in a black family, my father being one of those old-fashioned apostolic ministers, my parents loved my gay black sister as much as they loved any of us.
One movement that your union has been very instrumental in initiating and sustaining is the Fight for 15. I have seen a lot of leadership of black women on the street, and there's also been a lot of crossover, I think, between that movement and Black Lives Matter initiatives as well as immigrant justice.
Black Lives Matter, these women started Black Lives Matter, which are out of the labor movement, right? When they started, you know, especially, you know, white labor leaders, they're kind of puzzled. But their endurance and never giving up has really opened up a whole opportunity of building relationship. And their platform always involves labor, living wages, you know, the right to collectively bargain, right? The right to a union. And so they're just so amazing.
Is the Fight for 15 something that you've been involved in as in your work as civil rights director?
Yes. The $15 an hour campaign started out of SEIU and the service workers, but it was very close to our Making Change for Walmart campaign. We've been exposing Walmart for many years, and we had strikes over the years, and we had Black Friday actions, and we still have female workers that are discriminated against because of their pregnancy and, you know, and being fired. So I think the Walmart campaign and the Fight for 15 campaign, the fast food workers campaign, these campaigns have allowed all of labor, right, not just one union to be involved. Those movements have brought us together as one movement. I am on the board of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, which is a organization of black labor leaders, and we support the Fight for 15. We just had a big action in Baltimore just today. So, yeah, I love when workers come out to take ownership of their own plight. As when people take ownership of their, you know, organizing, it's powerful. It changes everything.
My guest is Robin Williams, Civil Rights Director for the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and we're discussing the recent report, And Still I Rise, Black Women Labor Leaders, Voices, Power, and Promise from the Black Worker Initiative. You know, so much of my experience in social justice movements has been about what a long haul it can be and, mm-hmm. you know, how slow change is. Yeah. And yet, $15 an hour, when people started talking about it not that long ago, even the people who were talking about it said, well, it's aspirational. You know, mm-hmm. we talk about 15 so that we can really get 12.
Right.
And yet now city after city, state after state are making $15 the minimum wage.
Yes.
And, you know, so maybe not on a national level, but really I think it's been so inspiring to see what grassroots organizing can really achieve.
Yes. When you don't give up, when it's just not like a phase, right? Because that's what they think, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, this is going to go away. You know, that's what they thought, you know, when Michael Brown's death. Oh, Black Lives Matter, it'll go away, right?
Yeah.
You know, oh, this Fight for 15, it'll go away. You know, organizing at Smithfield, 16 years. Oh, sooner or later, it's too hard, right? But when you have that endurance, and, you know, at one time, even union organizing, if organizers could not get a campaign started and they weren't getting, you know, people to be supportive of the union campaign fast enough, they would cut that campaign and just say, let's go on to something else. But now they're seeing that we got to create these movements that's everlasting. You know, once we win the $15 now, which we are winning, right, like you said, then we build on it, right? We build on it. Not only are we winning $15 an hour, but we also winning paid sick leave in areas, paid family leave. All these now policies that workers and communities are trying to move on, right? We're winning. We're winning.
What do you think makes the difference? You know, you said the labor movement used to sort of cut and run, and now they're realizing that that's not the way to do it. You know, what do you think has changed, has led to that change?
I think we got new energy. I think we have new ideas. I think every time we win something big, like, you know, the Smithfield campaign, then it sets the stage of saying, we got to stay in this, right? And I think that the workers won't let you go. Well, imagine if we walk away from Fight for 15 right now. Really? No. No union's going to do that, because I tell you, people remember. We have new activists now. Workers are fighting, you know, fighting and doing these one-day strike and going back to work. I think that we have more unity and communities, ministers and rabbis standing up with these workers. When the Fight for 15 workers, when they do these 1 and 2 day strikes, when they go back to work, most times a community leader walks them back to work to make sure that they get back in there. You know, I just think it's a combination. Workers won't let us stop. We got new energy. We know we got to change the strategy if we want to grow the labor movement.
One of the things that I learned from this report is that Black women have the highest rates of unionization, or of approving unions of any group of workers in the U.S., and campaigns with Black women leaders are the most successful. And yet the original question that the report seeks to address is, why has the organizing success of Black women not resulted in more Black women in leadership positions and helping to shape the direction of the labor movement? I assume part of that is racism and sexism within the labor movement. How have you experienced that, and, you know, how have you been able to confront or counter it?
Yeah, so... That's pretty challenging, and I'm sure probably a high percentage of all women, white women included, and Latino women that's in the labor movement, I'm sure have experienced sexism in some way. But Black women and Latino women, other women of color, we experience that double whammy. It's hard because we love our union. We love our union. And we want to make a difference. And a lot of times it makes you want to give up. And I have experienced racism. I have experienced not your time yet, or I can start a campaign or have an idea. Once that come out of your mouth, it's somebody else's. And they have it, and they write it up, and they get a budget for it. And guess what? They get a staff. And you don't have all of that, right? Or you win something, but you don't get credit for it. If myself as a Black woman in the labor movement, if I had let those things tear me apart and I walk away, and I've been offered other positions, then I wouldn't be where I am today, still trying to make sure that the voice of Black women, Black men, but all workers are heard, and that there is, you know, a different perspective. Because right now, you know, we're working on criminal justice reform in a way that we're doing restorative rights for those that were informally incarcerated. I've been blessed to have a president, international president, Mark Perron, that believes in that. So that's first, right? But we've worked and tried to push campaigns that we don't get support from leadership. And that's the hard part, where we have worked as organizers and we have brought people into our unions, and then we still are at the bottom of the list. When I was a union organizer, I was training people to become organizers. And they would go into another department before me. And after doing that for about a year or two, I went to my president and said, hey, wait, I'm training them to be organizers, and then you put them in another department. And he said, Robin, if I take you out of organizing, no one would be organizing. Well, how fair is that to me, right? But We experience this, and we still experience it because, you know, although we work for unions, not every a white man, a white woman, or black guy are going to treat us as equal in this movement. So I always weigh the situation. Do I walk away? If I walk away, what do my people have to gain or lose? I don't want to have a job where I'm just getting a paycheck. If I'm not making a difference, I don't want to be there. So I say it's always push. You push a little bit, and then you sit back, you know, because we as black women, you know, they already say, you know, we bitter, we this, we that. But I go to work every day, and I have a smile on my face, and there can be pain, but I'm one that I don't easily give up.
And
I hope that was okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I assume that you know some of these other women leaders who are profiled in this report, and you support each other.
Absolutely. I do know most of these women. And they interviewed 26 of us, but of course there are many more of us. Let me start with Petey Talley from Ohio, and she's featured in the report. Petey is the secretary treasurer of the Ohio State AFL-CIO. Petey's been in the labor movement for many years, and Petey is a sister mentor to me. I worked in Ohio in 2008. My union, we were part of Change to Win at that time, and I was one of the leads for the Obama campaign. And I learned so much from Petey Talley. Ohio, we won big in Ohio. And after the campaign, Ohio was hit for the first time with Right to Work. And Petey, being a leader at the AFL-CIO, when labor run campaigns like fighting Right to Work, they don't always think about us, the black community, as being partners, or they don't do literature that address the black community. But Right to Work was written to keep black workers out of the same workforce with white workers. That's why Right to Work was written.
Interesting. But, I didn't know that.
Yes, absolutely. And Right to Work laws affect black workers more than any other segment of workers. So Petey Talley, who again is featured in this report, Petey did something very unique. Petey works with an organization that she created called the Unity Campaign. And this Unity Campaign is an organization of all the black organizations in Ohio. So that includes labor unions, the NAACP, the Urban League, churches, black churches. So what she did, and I worked with Petey. Petey got the numbers and the data and had a report about if the state of Ohio went right to work, that means take the protections from public sector employees, how would that affect black workers in the state of Ohio? And so the numbers were like astonishing. I was surprised. Petey started having meetings with leaders in the black community, and we started organizing against Right to Work. Now, then she had the elected officials, black elected officials, where she was really teaching them what Right to Work would do to black workers. And so that was really great in helping to defeat Right to Work in Ohio. Rachel Bryan is another leader that's featured in the report, and Rachel is from California. And what's so unique about Rachel? Rachel is a young woman. She works in the Civil Rights Department of the IBEW, the Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Rachel come out of the criminal justice system, and while she was in the system, she went through an apprenticeship program to become an electrician. Then we have Dr. Toni Lewis. She's actually a doctor, and she is one of the vice presidents for SEIU, and she does yoga. So she really, when I get anxious, she helps me to come back to balance. And if I could just mention Dr. Loretta Johnson also from the American Federation of Teachers, who has also over the years been a mentor to me. These women that I named, they're from other unions, but we are all a part of one family. What's so good about a sister is that, you know, they tell you the truth, right? Whether it's something you want to hear or don't want to hear. But without my sister mentors, I probably would have lost my mind by now, right? Because this work is hard. You're discriminated against a lot or put down a lot or, you know, your ideas are stolen from you. But without these sisters that we can rely on, we can call, and I can call one of these sisters, and I can tell them things that I know it's not going anywhere other than with them. And then the response I get, I know it's going to be love.
I was raised to support unionization and unions, but I've never personally had the opportunity to be in one because I do office work in the legal industry and it's just not organized at all. And I mean, actually our one attempt was met with skepticism on the part of the unions because they just felt like, hey, these are the firms that fight us, you know, that try to kill our efforts. They're never going to let us organize their workers. I think that, you know, most of my listeners probably have not had the opportunity to be in unions because only something like 11% of workers are in unions in the country and only 6% of workers in the private sector at this point.
Right.
So what can people who might be listening who may not be Black women and may not be part of the organized labor movement, you know, what can we do to help achieve the goals of And Still I Rise, which is to get more Black women into leadership positions in the labor movement?
Well, I think you doing this interview, I think it's helpful. I know this report was helpful. When you talk about our work, it lifts us up. It really lifts us up into these leadership positions. You know, just say our names.
You know, I love that you said say our names because say their names, say her name, you know, has been a cry that we associate with the Black Lives Matter movement. But typically we mean women who've been killed by the police or women who are incarcerated. And I think one of the great things that this report does is present a picture of Black women who are coming into power, who are taking power, who have their struggles, but defy the image of Black women as only victims of severe oppression. And so, you know, read this report, enjoy these portraits of women who are doing incredible things, and as Robin Williams has said, say their names. Tell other people about the incredible women that you're reading about. And this is something every one of us can do. AndStillIRise.org, that's And Still I Rise with dashes in between the words. AndStillIRise.org is where you can download and read this entire inspiring and informative and interesting report by the Black Worker Initiative and the Institute for Policy Studies. Robin Williams has been my guest. She is the Civil Rights Director for the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union based in Washington, D.C. Robin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kate Raphael and KPFA Women's Magazine, for sharing this interview. Find more episodes of Women's Magazine at kpfa.org. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And please like our news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose newest book is called The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Some of them want to break you down, steal your crown. Use and abuse you.
some of them smile in your face, 'cause they hurt it someplace. They got more than they're used to. Some of them want to steal your love. Oh, 'cause they're jealous of how you've been living and giving. I keep moving forward, pressing onward, striving further. I keep on laughing, keep on living, keep on loving, yeah.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 6:59. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio, coming up next.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a new member and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KBOO. Thank you.
Ear to the streets, ear to the streets. Ear to the streets, ear to the streets.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the streets.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series at the Hollywood Theater. The film this month is Bird on a Wire, showing Friday, December 2nd at 7 p.m. Bird on a Wire is a documentary about recently and dearly departed Leonard Cohen. The film follows Cohen on his 1972 European tour. Live footage is combined with a very intimate look at Leonard's inner life, doubts, depressions, and triumphs.